Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up. The Daily Sun Up podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, May 24th. Today, the Sun's Kevin Simpson brings us another great conversation with a Colorado author. Before we begin, the Colorado Sun is partnering with multiple news outlets across the state to understand what is driving Coloradans this election year. What issues do you care about most as we head into the 2024 election? Let us know by filling out our survey at coloradosun.com/votervoices. Now let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On May 24, 1911, President William Howard Taft designated a large area of stone formations and canyons in Mesa County as Colorado National Monument using the Antiquities Act. The monument's establishment was largely due to John Otto, a figure some deemed eccentric or dangerous. After moving to the area in 1907, Otto tirelessly built trails, celebrated holidays with bonfires, and rallied local leaders to support the monument's creation. The area was protected from homesteading that same year, and Otto later became the park's superintendent, advocating for wildlife protection and trail building. Despite his efforts, disputes with local authorities led to his dismissal in 1927. The monument, originally suggested as Smith National Monument Park to attract tourists, retained the neutral name Colorado National Monument. Efforts to elevate it to a national park have periodically stalled, hindered by naming disputes and congressional inaction. Before we continue, join the Colorado Sun on June 25th as Equity reporter Tatiana Flowers speaks with a panel about how they see mental illness falling through the cracks, what some solutions are, or ways to address the issues, and more. The event is free and virtual. RSVP today at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Welcome to another Colorado Friday, listeners. You know, if the weather cooperates, it'll be a great weekend for getting outdoors. And if enjoying some of our state's public lands is on your agenda, chances are good you're part of the $1.1 trillion outdoor recreation industry, a field whose growth has evolved in many ways, especially in recent years. And our guest today is Luis Benitez, who is the Chief Impact Officer for Trust for Public Land and also the author of the new book, Higher Ground, How the Outdoor Recreation Industry Can Save the World. Welcome, Luis.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So saving the world, that's a pretty lofty pursuit. Tell us what you set out to do with this book and what you see as the outdoor recreation industry's role in everything from public health to the economy.
I know, right? Kind of a big title to encapsulate everything that we're talking about. But yet, you know, I think if you ask anybody from someone that may walk their dog around a local park, all the way to folks that are extreme adventurers, paddling, climbing, hiking, biking, boating, hunting, fishing, and everything in the middle, chances are everyone probably has that same feeling of doing these things makes their lives better. And I think when you start to look through the lens of what the overall industry looks and feels like collectively, I think that's the conversation that we're now starting to have. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling to think of us or this as a trillion-dollar economy responsible for 5 million American jobs. But the point that I try to get to is, what's the responsibility of the folks that are leading that? So how do we define equitable access to the outdoors? Should everyone in the United States be within 10 minutes of a green space? And is that green space clean, safe, and healthy? And then with regards to your question about public health, you know, how can we help go further than just saying, you know what, spending time outside is good for you, to actually incorporating it into the way we think and feel about how we live our daily lives?
Well, so let's talk a little bit here about how you became interested in the outdoors to begin with, because it's a fascinating story. And this weekend in our Sunlit feature, we have a really compelling excerpt from your book that just beautifully shows how your childhood struggles with asthma led you to become driven not only to enjoy the outdoors, but to literally climb to the top of the world multiple times. Tell our listeners about that journey.
Yeah, you know, I like to tell people that I've grown up in and around the outdoor industry my entire life. And that journey started with exactly what you're describing. I was a really sick little kid, had debilitating asthma and allergies, couldn't really go outside all that much. And the doctors were pretty clear with my parents that you better get him used to just being an indoor cat, if you will. Someone that doesn't go outside very much. Because it depending on what the allergen was, outside, I spent a lot of my youth in hospitals with asthma attacks, and my parents just weren't satisfied with that as a way to live, as a way their kid was going to live. And so they worked really hard to understand, how to make my lungs stronger and what that would take and what that would look like. And here's really where I got lucky. My mom's from the United States, but my dad is from Ecuador. And we started spending summers at high altitude in Latin America, where, you know, the air is thinner and cleaner, less pollutants. And my lungs slowly started to get stronger. And the unique thing with high altitude mountaineering that you'll hear from a lot of people is the higher you go, the harder it is to breathe. Well, being one of those kids that had struggled with breathing my entire life, ironically enough for me, as I slowly got into mountaineering and high altitude mountaineering, that instead of being a place of fear, was really a place of comfort for me. So it was this natural evolution of my career that sprung from that very personal place of breathing and what breath work does to help you be healthy.
I guess we should clarify here that you grew up not in Colorado at altitude, but in the Midwest. So you grew up at a lower altitude, and also there was a magazine that you saw that provided some inspiration for you, wasn't there?
Oh, Kevin, you've done your homework. That's great. Yeah, you know, so for me, obviously being indoors a lot and not being able to go outside all that much, I became a pretty voracious reader. And my dad had a collection of National Geographic magazines. And if you think of, you know, I just have these distinct memories as a kid of this shelf of yellow, all the spines of the National Geographic magazines, just being the sea of yellow. And so every night before bed, I would walk down this row of yellow magazines and read the description of what was inside of each one on the spines. And I came across a 1963 edition that had an article about the first American expedition to climb Mount Everest. And I read the article, and it turns out that Jim Whittaker, the first American to climb Everest, who ironically enough also was the first CEO of REI, also had asthma and allergies. And his parents threw him in lakes up around Mount Rainier, made him climb up on the glaciers of Mount Rainier to get his lungs stronger. And this article talked about how spending time outside actually helped him overcome a lot of those illnesses. And I remember as a young kid dragging this magazine into my parents' bedroom and pointing to the picture of Jim Whittaker and saying, "This guy has exactly what I have, and this is what I'm going to do. I want to be a mountaineer, and I want to climb Mount Everest." And so, you know, you're absolutely right. Growing up in the Midwest, where, you know, the heat and humidity sort of is a delivery vehicle for allergens and pollutants, makes the air heavier and denser and moves those things around. You know, I'd tell people, anyone would ask, "Little boy, what do you want to be when you grow up?" I'd say, "I want to be a mountaineer. I'd want to climb Mount Everest." And then I'd take a puff off of my inhaler and I'd go wheezing on my merry way. So, you know, really the dream of a kid that I never let go of. I saw that as a distinct goal of what I wanted to do, and how I got to do it was really a part of that story of my life's journey.
Our listeners obviously can't see this, but I'm, you know, looking at you on sort of a Zoom camera here, and I see sort of a oblong mural in the background there of mountains. Is that Everest by chance?
It is. Yeah. So it's Mount Everest. It's Lhotse and Nupse, which are two neighboring peaks to Everest. And so, you know, I tell people all the time, Kevin, that an Everest expedition in years past was about 3 months total, door to door, from the time you left to the time you came back. And I had been on the mountain, have been on the mountain 7 times. So if you add that up, you know, 7 times 3, you know, and then divide by months, that's a significant portion of my life, in one place, under one endeavor. And I think, you know, it the Himalayas and the Sherpa community, will always hold a special place in my heart, because I think that is really where I stepped into the truth of my life and the capacity of what I was capable of.
Now, you wrote this book with a longtime friend of yours, Frederick Reimers. Tell us about that relationship and how Higher Ground sort of grew out of your conversations with him.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Frederick and I have been friends for 20 years, another part of my history. And actually, the thing that brought me to Colorado was the Colorado Outward Bound School, being an Outward Bound instructor. And Frederick and I were Outward Bound instructors together. He was much more of a river rat, leading programs on all of Colorado and Utah's rivers. I was what they referred to as an all-terrain vehicle. So I did mountaineering trips and river trips and canyoneering trips as well. And we met actually on a river rescue, where we had a student in really bad weather become hypothermic. And in the efforts of an all night and all day affair to get her out and get her medical help, that really cemented our friendship. And over the years, Frederick has become this incredible writer. You know, I can't brag enough about him. He just wrote this amazing piece that showed up in the New York Times about literally, you know, his relationship with his former dog that he lost recently, and how that sort of shaped relationships in his life. He has this unique capacity to help shape a story, unlike anybody I've ever met before. And as I evolved into my mountaineering and guiding career, he evolved into this amazing journey as a journalist and as a writer. And through our friendship, as I started speaking up and out more about the political voice of the outdoor industry, the first person I called when I had the idea of how to shape the narrative of the story we should tell around that was Frederick. And so this was really a three and a half year labor of love with the both of us that really began just with our relationship in the outdoors and storytelling. And what would we want to say? How would we want to say it? And while I would argue, you know, a lot of the stories in Higher Ground are personal to me, Frederick is very much present in a lot of them, because a lot of my stories, you know, you could exchange our names, and he's been through similar things as well. So I will always be grateful to him for our friendship and the partnership on this project.
You know, so many authors that I've talked to over the course of the last few years have mentioned a pandemic story behind their books. It seems like the pandemic really impacted authors in some very interesting and different ways. And COVID figured into your process as well, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. You know, I think like everybody, COVID was really a moment to be reflective on where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. And, you know, Frederick, as a journalist, wrote a lot of pieces about myself and my efforts when I worked for then Governor, now Senator Hickenlooper, with creating the Outdoor Recreation Industry Office for Colorado and helping trying to convince other governors to create outdoor industry offices for their states. And Frederick was sort of my go-to journalist, along with a few others, for making sure that story continued to be told nationally. And during the pandemic, we were talking one day, and you know, the way we worked, because of how busy it was working for Governor Hickenlooper, he would just record our conversations, and talking about how it's going, where we're going, what's going on. And I think the thing that we came to, and you'll probably remember this during the pandemic, the one thing everyone from the government to local leaders said was okay to do was spend time outside. And spending time outside, the everybody getting outdoors just exploded, absolutely exploded. You couldn't buy, you know, you couldn't find a raincoat, let alone a sleeping bag or a tent. And so it really drove home this conversation of what is our responsibility as an industry? Is it just to make stuff? Is it to protect these spaces? Does that dialogue extend all the way to policymaking in Washington, D.C.? Do we have a responsibility to do more than just shape a narrative around the fun stuff? Do we actually have a responsibility to shape a narrative around this economy and this economic engine for the country? And the answer that Frederick and I landed on was yes. And so in the midst of really busy day jobs for the both of us, we started shaping that narrative during the pandemic.
To kind of pick up on that thread a little more, one of the themes you mention in the book is the need to treat nature as infrastructure, which I thought was a really interesting concept. What do you mean by that, and why is it important?
Oh, it's such a great question, Kevin. You know, I think it's already happening. It's already happening. When you look at towns, and I'll go urban and rural. So let's talk about urban first. When you talk about a city like Denver, that puts in bike lanes, we have green spaces, we try to understand trail connectivity from the urban corridor to the outer rings of the city. And then you have the Office of Economic Development for Denver, when they're trying to recruit a headquarters to town, put in that proposal a definition of what quality of life in Denver looks like. And that quality of life is codified by the trail systems, green spaces, access to rivers and creeks and lakes. When we're recruiting Fortune 50 and Fortune 500 headquarters to town. So all of a sudden, that infrastructure that's usually seen as just an amenity for a city and a nice to have is turning into a need to have with respect to a value proposition for economic development. So that's just not just nature is nature, that's nature is infrastructure. I'll give you another example. The Trust for Public Lands just literally yesterday released a thing that we call Park Score. And it's literally through our own metrics and our own mechanism, looks at major urban corridors and helps them define what their park score is with respect to tree canopy, green space integration, trail systems, and the connectivity to their citizenry. And again, before, I think that was really seen as a nice to have, but now a lot of communities that are ranked within our park score system at the Trust for Public Land, look at that with respect to heat sinks now. As temperatures get warmer and warmer in the summertime, if they look at their ranking and then look at the heat-related illnesses that they're finding more and more in the summertime and start to ask, you know what? Planting more trees based on this score isn't about raising our ranking on park score. This is about protecting our citizenry. So that's nature's infrastructure in the urban core. Now let's talk about the rural corridor for a minute. You know, probably through looking into my history, that I lived in Eagle, Colorado for a really long time. I was a town councilman there. And, you know, it's a small bedroom community to arguably the ski industry in both Avon and Edwards and in Vail. And, you know, when we started looking at really what our value proposition was to town, and we started looking at our mountain biking trail system, our river corridor, how do we recruit businesses to our main street? The one amenity that we recognized that we have that we weren't fully utilizing was the outdoor infrastructure. And so when we invested town money that we didn't have a lot of at the time into growing and integrating our mountain biking trail infrastructure, we got a lot of pushback saying, you know, we don't necessarily, that's a nice to have. What we need is another septic system. What we need is better lighting on Main Street. And our argument was, if we focus on this and promote it correctly, economic development will come. And sure enough, we landed the high school mountain biking championships year after year. The river corridor. I'll give you a great example, and hopefully you visited it. CDOT used to have a semi-truck depot right outside of the entrance to Eagle on I-70. It was just a pit stop. It was a patch of gravel off the road adjacent to the river where truckers could stop, take their chains off, put their chains on, coming down the pass, maybe catch some hours of sleep if they were at their limit of driving. And that just wasn't acceptable to town leadership. We saw the economic value of looking at our river corridor and understanding how to both protect and promote the river health and the riparian environment's health, but also create a recreational amenity that people could see from the highway and town could utilize. And now, with the help of a kaleidoscope of supporters. It's arguably one of the best whitewater parks in the state. And so when you look at nature as infrastructure for rural communities, there's this distinct opportunity to leverage those amenities in a really holistic way. So when I say nature as infrastructure, we're already treating it like that. I think that just the time has come to call it what it is.
Well, Luis, you mentioned that several years ago, you worked with then Governor John Hickenlooper in the Outdoor Recreation Industry Office. I was curious, has Colorado been a leader in addressing the importance of what you call the OREC industry, or are we playing catch up at this point?
Well, you know me, I'm always willing to ask how we can do better. You know, I think now, Kevin, there are over 20 states that have outdoor industry offices. That was a deeply important thing to me. It's a deeply important thing to our current director, Connor Hall, who's a good friend. And, you know, I think one of the things that generated, that came from Colorado, was the Confluence Accords, which were drafted here in Colorado. And that is basically a sort of a Magna Carta for outdoor industry offices that tells each state's governor and outdoor industry office director that if you're going to create this office, here are the ways that we agree to connect and try to work within four distinct lanes: economic development, conservation and stewardship, education and workforce development, and public health. So when you become a signatory of the accords, you agree to operate within those four areas. And that was created in Colorado. I'm incredibly proud of that. Connor continues to carry that forward. And with respect to your question about playing catch up versus being in the lead, you know, every state has a unique approach to this, which I think is the beauty of the offices. And I think the other beauty of the offices is the directors actually talk. This is the one state director, nonpartisan entity that I can arguably point to that the directors get together on a monthly call to talk about best practices, what works, what doesn't. And leadership rotates of that group every single year, and it sees no political strife. But when you ask if we're leading the way or not, you know, I would remind all of your listeners that coming up on June 1st and 2nd, Denver is going to be hosting the very first of its kind outside festival. And this is truly the first of its kind business to consumer engagement where the industry can show up and show any consumer, anybody that wants to come and hang out, all of the things that we fight for with respect to climate, policies around public lands, clean air, clean water, what we try to do with our products. So it's not just about highlighting the new sexy puffy jacket or piece of outdoor gear, but talking about how we do deeply dive into some of these things. And I am so proud of Connor in his work in the office and of Governor Polis's efforts to bring this to life. So trying to keep all bias aside, I think Colorado is definitely in the leader chair because of that.
And just listeners, we've had a story. If you looked at on the Colorado Sun news site, we do have a story about the outdoor festival coming up. Also, another thing I wanted, since I have you here, I wanted to touch base on another story that just came out earlier this week. Our own Jason Blevins did a story on this, and I'm sure it's something that you're following as well. But it talked about how some thriving Colorado outdoor businesses are getting bought up by larger companies and then moved out of state. I'm just wondering if that's sort of a natural progression these days, that the bigger fish eat the smaller fish, or is it a concern at this stage?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kevin. You know, a part of me is really happy that that's happening, because what that means is that we have acquired a level of sophistication within the marketplace where mergers and acquisitions actually happen. So when you really think about that, right, all of the smaller boutique brands, the mom and pop shops, if you would have said M&A to any of those brands or mom and pop shops, even 10 or 15 years ago, they would have thought you were crazy. But yet we have an e-bike company that was acquired by a large holding company out of Eagle, Colorado, Quiet Cat. In a lot of different ways, I argue that this should be happening, because what it allows is room for innovation and, by the way, room for what's next. Now, the immediate pain of the loss of jobs and the moving of that brand outside of town, you know, towns rely on those brands being there as a source of both marketing efforts and also just, frankly, town pride. You know, I know Eagle's really proud to have Quiet Cat there and be able to have a storefront on Main Street that people would destination travel to get a bike. And so I think the argument can be made on both sides that it shows a level of sophistication that I'm really excited about, because that proves that we're behaving like a trillion-dollar economy, which grows our political voice ultimately in the end. And I think we always need to pay attention to the impacts to our smaller communities with some of this movement, because not all of these brands come out of large cities where the impact is small. Some of these brands come out of rural communities. So my ask whenever I hear any of these things happening is that the holding company pays very, very close attention to how they do that. And the examples I'll give you are, you know, how I think I see, you know, the larger entities that absorb these brands behaving is that they'll open a brick and mortar footprint in town as these brands leave, to maybe not completely maintain zero job loss, but to show and honor the place where the original innovation came from.
Well, once again, listeners, the name of the book is Higher Ground: How the Outdoor Recreation Industry Can Save the World. And it's available at fine bookstores everywhere. And remember to check out the excerpt and the Q&A with author Luis Benitez starting this Sunday at coloradosun.com. Thanks for joining us, Luis.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, please remember to leave a review on whatever platform you use to tune in. Thanks, and we'll do this again next week.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Property owners were once again a focus of Colorado's 2024 legislative session, with lawmakers cutting property taxes by over $1 billion. For renters, the session was a mixed bag. Lawmakers approved funding for affordable housing, adopted reforms aimed at bringing down costs, and bolstered protections for tenants. But a tax break for renters died on the calendar, and the Senate gutted a bill that would have protected tenants from anti-competitive rent-setting algorithms seen as a factor in recent rent spikes. A corpse flower named Cosmo is expected to bloom for the first time in Fort Collins over Memorial Day weekend. The plant has lived at Colorado State University for nearly 8 years after CSU Plant Growth Facilities Manager Tammy Brenner brought it back from a conference. She has cared for it ever since. When the bloom occurs, this rare plant will emit a putrid odor that has been compared to the smell of decaying flesh. The public will be able to see and smell Cosmo after the bloom occurs, which is predicted for Sunday or Monday. Fast-growing northern Colorado will get $250 million from the state to complete two controversial water projects. The loans will help finance a new dam outside Loveland and a major regional water project northwest of Fort Collins. Vetted by the Colorado Water Conservation Board and approved by a bipartisan group of lawmakers May 1st, the $155 million for Chimney Hollow Reservoir and the $100 million for the Northern Integrated Supply Project are among the largest financing packages the state has approved in recent years. Northern Water is the agency that is leading the projects. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect. Issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.